Chapter 7. Paul was a sailor and he had known the river for years. But in our consulate where I arrived dripping after a sharp walk, they could tell me nothing. The excellent young men on the staff, though willing to help me, belonged to a sphere of the white colony for which that sort of Johnson does not exist. Their suggestion was that I should hunt the man up myself with the help of the consulate's constable and ex-sergeant major of a regiment of hussars. This man, whose usual duty apparently consisted in sitting behind a little table in an outer room of consular offices, when ordered to assist me in my search for Johnson, displayed lots of energy and a marvelous amount of local knowledge of a sort. But he did not conceal an immense and sceptical contempt for the whole business. We explored together on that afternoon an infinity of infamous grog shops, gambling dens, opium dens. We walked up narrow lanes, where our gharry, a tiny box of a thing on wheels, attached to a jibbing Burma pony, could by no means have passed. The constable seemed to be on terms of scornful intimacy with Maltese, with Eurasians, with Chinamen, with Klings, and with the sweepers attached to a temple, with whom he talked at the gate. We interviewed also through a grating in a mud wall closing a blind alley an immensely corpulent Italian, who, the ex-sergeant major remarked to me perfunctorily, had killed another man last year. Thereupon he addressed him as Donio and Old Buck, though that bloated carcass, apparently more than half filling the sort of cell wherein it sat, recalled rather a fat pig in a sty. Familiar and never unbending, the sergeant chucked under the chin a horribly wrinkled and shriveled old hag propped on a stick, who had volunteered some sort of information. And with the same stolid face he kept up an animated conversation with the groups of swathed brown women, who sat smoking cheroots on the doorsteps of a long range of clay hovels. We got out of the gharry, and clambered into dwellings airy like packing crates, or descended into places sinister like cellars. We got in, we drove on, we got out again for the sole purpose, as it seemed, of looking behind a heap of rubble. The sun declined. My companion was curt and sardonic in his answers, but it appears we were just missing Johnson all along. At last our conveyance stopped once more with a jerk, and the driver jumping down opened the door. A black mud hole blocked the lane. A mound of garbage crowned with the dead body of a dog arrested us not. An empty Australian beef tin bounded cheerily before the toe of my boot. Suddenly we clambered through a gap in a prickly fence. It was a very clean native compound. And the big native woman, with bare brown legs as thick as bedposts, pursuing on all fours a silver dollar that came rolling out from somewhere, was Mrs. Johnson herself. "Our man's at home," said the ex-sergeant, and stepped aside in complete and marked indifference to anything that might follow. Johnson at home stood with his back to a native house built on posts, and with its walls made of mats. In his left hand he held a banana. Out of the right he dealt another dollar into space. The woman captured this one on the wing, and there and then plumped down on the ground, to look at us with greater comfort. My man was sallow of face, grizzled, unshaven, muddy on elbows and back, where the seams of his serge coat yawned you could see his white nakedness. The vestiges of a paper collar encircled his neck. He looked at us with a grave, swaying surprise. "Here do you come from?" he asked. My heart sank. How could I have been stupid enough to waste energy and time for this? But having already gone so far, I approached a little nearer and declared the purpose of my visit. He would have to come at once with me, sleep on board my ship, and tomorrow, with the first of the ebb, he would give me his assistance in getting my ship down to the sea, without steam. A 600-ton bark, drawing 9 feet aft. I proposed to give him $18 for his local knowledge, and all the time I was speaking he kept on considering attentively the various aspects of the banana, holding first one side up to his eye, then the other. "You've forgotten to apologize," he said at last with extreme precision. "Odd being a gentleman yourself, You don't know, apparently, when you intrude upon a gentleman. I am one. I wish you to understand that, when I am in funds I don't work, and now. Dot, I would have pronounced him perfectly sober and he paused in great concern to try and brush a hole off the knee of his trousers. I have money and friends. Every gentleman has. Perhaps you would like to know my friend? His name is Falk. You could borrow some money. Try to remember. F.A. 50. K. Falk. Abruptly his tone changed. Noble heart, he said muzzily. Has Falk been giving you some money? I asked, appalled by the detailed finish of the dark plot. Lent me, my good man, not given me. Lent, he corrected suavely. At me taking the air last evening, and being as usual anxious to oblige, hadn't you better go to the devil out of my compound? And upon this, without other warning, he let fly with the banana which missed my head, and took the constable just under the left eye. He rushed at the miserable Johnson, stammering with fury. They fell. ... But why dwell on the wretchedness, the breathlessness, the degradation, the senselessness, the weariness, the ridicule and humiliation and the perspiration of these moments? I dragged the ex-hussar off. He was like a wild beast. It seems he had been greatly annoyed at losing his free afternoon on my account. The garden of his bungalow required his personal attention, and at the slight blow of the banana the brute in him had broken loose. We left Johnson on his back, still black in the face, but beginning to kick feebly. Meantime, the big woman had remained sitting on the ground, apparently paralyzed with extreme terror. For half an hour we jolted inside our rolling box, side by side, in profound silence. The ex-sergeant was busy staunching the blood of a long scratch on his cheek. Hope you're satisfied, he said suddenly. That's what comes of all that tomfool business. If you hadn't quarreled with that tugboat skipper over some girl or other, all this wouldn't have happened. You heard that story? I said. Of course I heard. And I shouldn't wonder if the consul general himself doesn't come to hear of it. How am I to go before him tomorrow with that thing on my cheek, I want to know? It's you who ought to have got this. After that, till the Gary stopped, and he jumped out without leave-taking, he swore to himself steadily, horribly, muttering great, purposeful, trooper oaths, to which the worst a sailor can do is like the prattle of a child. For my part I had just the strength to crawl into Schomburg's coffee room, where I wrote at a little table a note to the mate instructing him to get everything ready for dropping down the river next day. I couldn't face my ship. Well, as he had a clever sort of skipper, and no mistake, poor thing. What a horrid mess. I took my head between my hands. At times the obviousness of my innocence would reduce me to despair. What had I done? If I had done something to bring about the situation, I should at least have learned not to do it again. But I felt guiltless to the point of imbecility. The room was empty yet. Only Schomburg prowled round me goggle-eyed, and with a sort of odd respectful cubic curiosity. No doubt he had set the story going himself, but he was a good-hearted chap, and I am really persuaded he participated in all my troubles. He did what he could for me. He ranged aside the heavy match stand, set a chair straight, pushed a spittoon slightly with his foot as you show small attentions to a friend under a great sorrow side, and at last, unable to hold his tongue. Well, I warn you, Captain. That's what comes of running your head against Mr. Falk. Man'll stick at nothing. I sat without stirring, and after surveying me with a sort of commiseration in his eyes he burst out in a hoarse whisper, colon, but for a fine lump of a girl, she's a fine lump of a girl. He made a loud smacking noise with his thick lips. He finest lump of a girl that I ever. Dottie was going on with great unction, but for some reason or other broke off. I fancied myself throwing something at his head. Don't blame you, Captain. Hang me if I do, he said with a patronizing air. Thank you, I said resignedly. It was no use fighting against this false fate. I don't know, even if I was sure myself, where the truth of the matter began. The conviction that it would end disastrously had been driven into me by all the success I've shocks my sense of security had received. I began to ascribe an extraordinary potency to agents in themselves powerless. It was as if Schomburg's baseless gossip had the power to bring about the thing itself, or the abstract enmity of fog could put my ship ashore. I have already explained how fatal this last would have been. For my further action, my youth, my inexperience, my very real concern for the health of my crew, must be my excuse. The act in itself, when it came, was purely impulsive. It was set in movement quite undiplomatically and simply by Falk's appearance in the doorway. The room was full by then, and buzzing with voices. I had been looked at with curiosity by everyone, but how am I to describe the sensation produced by the appearance of Falk himself blocking the doorway? The tension of expectation could be measured by the profundity of the silence that fell upon the very click of the billiard balls. As to Schomburg, he looked extremely frightened. He hated mortally any sort of row, fracas he called it, in his establishment. Fracas was bad for business, he affirmed. But, in truth, this specimen of portly, middle-aged manhood was of a timid disposition. I don't know what, considering my presence in the place, they all hoped would come of it. A sort of stag fight, perhaps. Or they may have supposed Falk had come in, only to annihilate me completely. As a matter of fact, Falk had come in, because Herman had asked him to inquire after the precious white cotton parasol which, in the worry and excitement of the previous day, he had forgotten at the table where we had held our little discus scion. It was this that gave me my opportunity. I don't think I would have gone to seek Falk out. No. I don't think so. There are limits. But there was an opportunity and I seized it. I have already tried to explain why. Now I will merely state that, in my opinion, to get a sickly crew into the sea air and secure a quick dispatch for his ship, a skipper would be justified in going to any length, short of absolute crime. He should put his pride in his pocket. He may accept confidences, explain his innocence as if it were a sin. He may take advantage of misconceptions, of desires and of weaknesses. He ought to conceal his horror and other emotions, and, if the fate of a human being, and that human being a magnificent young girl, is strangely involved, why, he should contemplate that fate, whatever it might seem to be, without turning a hair. And all these things I have done. The explaining, the listening, the pretending even to the discretion, and nobody, not even Herman's niece, I believe, need throw stones at me now. Schomburg at all events need, since from first to last, I am happy to say, there was not the slightest fracas. Overcoming a nervous contraction of the windpipe, I had managed to exclaim, "Captain Falk." His start of surprise was perfectly genuine, but afterwards he neither smiled nor scowled. He simply waited. Then, when I had said, "I must have a talk with you," and had pointed to a chair at my table, he moved up to me, though he didn't sit down. Schomburg, however, with a long tumbler in his hand, was making towards us prudently, and I discovered then the only sign of weakness in Falk. He had for Schomburg a repulsion resembling that sort of physical fear some people experience at the sight of a toad. Perhaps to a man so essentially and silently concentrated upon himself, though he could talk well enough, as I was to find out presently, the other's irrepressible loquacity, embracing every human being within range of the tongue, might have appeared unnatural, disgusting, and monstrous. He suddenly gave signs of restiveness positively like a horse about to rear, and, muttering hurriedly as if in great pain, "No. I can't stand that fellow," seemed ready to bolt. This weakness of his gave me the advantage at the very start. "Aranda," I suggested, as if rendering him a service, and walked him out by the arm. We stumbled over a few chairs. We had the feeling of open space before us, and felt the fresh breath of the river fresh, but tainted. The CHI Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.